and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. Today demonstrates, however, those are just the more familiar possibilities. Lieutenant Colonel Jess Langerud graduated Gustavus with a major in nursing in 1996, and his job titles since then have included Chief Information Officer, Director of Innovation, Vice President of Digital Transformation, Director of Nursing, and Hospital Director. In addition to his BA, Lieutenant Colonel Langerud holds an MBA from the University of Minnesota's Carlson School of Management and an MA in International Relations and Affairs from the University of Oklahoma. He's worked in the civilian health sector and also enjoyed an accomplished career with the United States Army, most recently as Medical Security Cooperation Officer for the U.S. Army Europe and Africa Command, which has involved him in a major ongoing collaborative project with the Polish military centered on medical training and readiness. And as we record, he's 2 days into his new position as commander of an Army Reserve Civil Affairs Battalion in Buckeye, Arizona. I first learned about Lieutenant Colonel Langerud's work from his daughter Ainsley, currently a senior history major at Gustavus, who, full disclosure, has taken courses with me and is one of my advisees. Hearing her, I knew right away that I wanted to learn more about her dad and what he does, which is why I'm delighted he could join me in conversation today. So, Lieutenant Colonel, Jess, if I may, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on.
Hey, thanks. I appreciate the invitation.
And what are you called by? I mean, people address you as Lieutenant Colonel. Is that how it works? Or Colonel? I don't know.
Yeah, all of the above. Lieutenant Colonel, Colonel, Sir, Boss. Okay. I'm sure there's other names that they use when I'm not in the room. but, you know, it all works.
All right, that's great. I was once in the Civil Air Patrol very briefly, and we were – all I remember is being trained. You know, we never flew. That's why I finally quit. It was ridiculous. All we did was march and learn how to salute, which is maybe what the Army's all about. I don't know. Anyway, that's as close as I came to military service. So, yeah, it's a real pleasure. I've learned so much about you from talking to Ainsley, and I've been looking forward to this. So why don't we start? I like to start with the person and the person's background. So why don't you tell us a little bit about where you grew up? And did you come from a military background yourself, for example?
Well, my dad served in Vietnam, and then, of course, both of my grandfathers served in World War II, but they weren't career military. They got called up for service. They did their piece. I want to say both, you know, all of them absolutely benefited from GI Bill and other things like that. But my own upbringing, you know, my dad was a salesman and then eventually started his own business. My mom is a master crafter with anything that has to do with fabric. And so, you know, sure, her own occupations did everything from running her own furniture reupholstery service to creating drapes. There was a stint there where she even worked for a casket company in Minneapolis, where she actually helped sew and craft the interiors to caskets, which I think is a very unique and interesting little tidbit of, you don't that think of that being a thing, yeah. But it is.
That's amazing. Yeah. Technically, I'm a labor historian, and I love those kinds of stories about how people – it's one reason I like doing the podcast, because I get to learn about, like, for you example, how you work. But, yeah, whoever thought, right? You look at that – I don't know if it's satin sometimes or whatever it is, and, yeah, how did that get made?
Yeah.
your mom.
And, yeah, the custom orders and what different people want or what families want inside or how it's made or what's on the pillow or how the pillow looks and – Yeah, just fascinating. And so very much middle class upbringing.
Was it in Minneapolis? Is that where you were?
So we kind of moved around a bit as I was a kid, everywhere from, you know, I think I was born, we lived in the Nicollet neighborhood of Minneapolis, and then we were down in Austin, Minnesota as I started elementary school. I can still remember waking up and smelling the Hormel plant down the road every now and then.
Yes.
To, you know, then coming back up to the metro area and to the Brooklyn Center community before we finally landed and really kind of stayed and homesteaded in the Anoka Coon Rapids area. And that's where both myself and my sister finished our high school careers before going off to our post high school colleges and activities and such.
Did your sister go to Gustavus also?
Nope, she was a Cobber. She went to Concordia up in Fargo Moorhead. I definitely think I chose better, just based on weather. We're both Mayak, you know, through and through, but you know, she was a Cobber and I went to Gustavus.
Well, what made you choose Gustavus? I mean, was it a conscious choice or was it just sort of, I don't know if your parents had gone there, if you knew someone had gone there. How did you wind up at Gustavus?
You know, that's kind of all the way through, I'm going to say my whole life / career, you know, serendipity has kind of just been a continual force. When I actually graduated high school, I was actually all signed up and ready to go to a small liberal arts college out in Maryland because I wanted to go sailing and be on their sailing team. But something, I don't even remember what specifically it was, as that summer after high school kind of came together and we said, you know what, I'm going to take a gap year. And through that gap year, ended up, you know, working for Health East Transportation and doing kind of like scheduled ambulance deliveries with people and meeting some other folks. And through that, ended up saying, okay, I'm going to go to Gustavus. And so then the following fall, I matriculated at Gustavus and never looked back after that. And, you know, one of the best choices I think I ever made early in my career that I don't think I'd be where I am had I not made some of those decisions.
That's just great. A theme of the podcast is serendipity. And so I just love that. I mean, the way, and it's important, I think, for current students, especially, and potential, you know, prospective students to understand, you don't have to have it all figured out. And sometimes serendipity plays a really important role in one's, well, not sometimes, often in one's life. Were you kind of already interested in the nursing major because of that experience with the ambulance service, or is the nursing major something you came to only after a while?
Well, so it was kind of in the back of my head. I had actually gotten my emergency medical technician certification while I was actually still in high school.
Oh, boy.
So I was interested in medicine, but coming into Gustavus, I wasn't really certain that I was sold that I wanted to be a doctor. And so I was looking for a pathway that could let me continue to do what I liked in medicine, but not spend the next 12 years in school. Right. And you know, because of the EMT stuff, I was always interested in emergency medicine. And, you know, my career has really kind of blossomed in and around that field as a launch point in so many different things that I've done. So nursing was kind of like my fast track to get me back to the emergency room. And it worked and it was great.
Was there, I have a friend who's now retired, but did some, he's a nurse, a retired nurse, and he did some ER work and would talk about that. I mean, was there a kind of an adrenaline rush for you? What attracted you to that work of the EMT and emergency room nursing?
I think what I really appreciated and liked about emergency medicine and still do is one, the tremendous variety of, you know, clinical issues that you can come across, even in a given shift or a week or whichever else. So you end up being a jack of almost every trade, but a master of very few. You know, and I kind of like to tell people, you know, it's the emergency room's job to kind of clean up the blood, make the patient look prettier, stabilize them, and then transfer them off to the inpatient nurses that don't like to handle the mess and the everything else. And so we stabilize the chaos and then pass the critical patients on to the inpatient nurses that can then get them back on the road to recovery. And then
that's
a good description. Yeah. And the other thing I really enjoyed was just kind of the sense of camaraderie. You know, the emergency department team really is a team of teams. There aren't too many other places within the health system where, you know, everybody from the technician to the respiratory therapist, the nurse, the physician, surgeon, or any other specialists are needed, are really working, you know, elbow to elbow in a time compressed and collaborative fashion. And so I really appreciated that, and kind of thrived in that environment.
That all makes sense to me. And echoes what this friend has said. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is we still have a terrific nursing program at Gustavus, but it's changed. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, when you were there, were we a part of a, I don't know if you call it a consortium with St. Olaf as well? Okay. So do you have any memories of that? I mean, did you go to St. Olaf, or faculty from Olaf came to Gustavus to teach? And did you go up to the cities? Just say a little bit more about your actual education at Gustavus as a nursing major.
Yeah, so when I went through, we used to climb the steps of Old Main up to the top.
Oh, yeah.
and the classrooms and the labs and everything else were up there. The faculty would go between the various campuses. The students would stay on campus for lecture and labs in on campus. And then the clinical sites, we would drive up to the cities on Tuesdays and Thursdays to conduct our clinicals, which, you know, when you have to be there for change of shift at 07, when they start up there, it was some early mornings leaving Gustavus to get to Fairview, Southdale, or wherever else we were going. And then, you know, we would do our work and then come back at the end of the afternoon.
A current nursing faculty member, Heidi Meyer, who I think she said she was maybe a couple of years either ahead or behind you, but she mentioned in an email to me to ask you about that drive up to the Twin Cities. And because she said she had some fond memories of conversations and friendships that grew out of the ride in the van up to the you know, sites.
Right?
Is that true? Do you have any, does that resonate?
Yeah. I mean, I think we were also especially tight because it was a relatively small program at the time that, because of the rules of the consortium and everything else like that. I think each class year was maybe sub 35, sub 40 students. And I know there were way more people that were applying to get in than what the program could accommodate at the time, but it was interesting. And, you know, great friendships, great partnerships, you know, getting together to study for exams or work on our quote unquote nursing care plans and other, milestone type activities that we all had to do. It was a great program, and no regrets at all.
Yeah, I always thought, I know it's a great program. I've always said, I'm not the only faculty member who said this. Some of the best students I've ever had were our nursing students, and I don't know what that's about, the self discipline and athletes, which reminds me, I want to ask you about that in a second, but. Yeah, just a great program still, even without the consortium. What so did you have time to take? I mean, I knew you had to take probably gen ed courses, but did you have time to take any electives, or were you pretty scheduled? For example, did you take any history courses?
You know,
daughter's a history major.
It is interesting. And now, as much as I enjoy history, that's probably one of the things I didn't get to experience. I did come away with a minor in English, and then spent a good time with the speech communications team.
Oh yeah. Oh.
For some of my other activities that I did on campus and some of the other departments that I really enjoyed. I do wish I'd spent more with the history team, but there just wasn't enough time and space to do it.
Yeah, no, I know the nursing, you know, and ed majors too. There's just so many courses you have to take. That's it. So were you on the debate team?
I did it once for a J term, and then for a short amount of time after that. But really, once I got into my junior and senior year, because of the clinical schedule and stuff like that, it just made it super tough to participate in some of those other activities, because we were away and traveling so much, and so it just got tough to do those other types of things.
Yeah. What was the clinical experience like? Were you doing different aspects of medicine at the sites, or how did that work?
Yeah, so they would rotate us around, so I think our very first clinical experience was right there in St. Peter at the medical center, and it was kind of like the general medical surgical. And then we would do pediatrics upstairs, up in the cities. We did labor and delivery. We did actually a mental health at the psychiatric hospital right there in St. Peter. Oh, wow. I'm sure there are others that I'm forgetting.
Yeah. So it sounds like a fairly rounded experience. You weren't specializing really at that.
No, not at all. It was kind of the shotgun blast and introduction to, everything that's out there.
Yeah. Do you have memories of some of the nursing faculty? I'm trying to think. I don't know if Barb Zust was there yet, but Judy Gardner, I'm trying to think who would have been among
Judy
the
Gardner
teachers.
was my academic advisor.
Oh yeah, she's great. Yeah.
Kay Wald and some
others. Oh, Kay, yes. Oh my gosh, Kay's great. Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm sure if I reach back into my memory, I'd come up with others. But those
Judy
two specifically were critical in my time.
You were in good hands. They're both great people. I got to know them a bit, in various capacities. So, as colleagues. So, Ainsley mentioned you also played football. Is that true?
So I was a walk-on senior year. I finally decided, okay, I wanted to play my entire, time and career there, and I wasn't able to do it, but senior year, and called up coach and ended up working with Coach Brown. I wasn't very good, but I certainly enjoyed being on the team. And the one thing it probably did parlay into me further in my life since Gustavus is I became an NFL, or not an NFL, I became a football official. Doing high school and college officiating.
Oh, that's great.
Both as I moved around with different jobs, I started doing it in Virginia and in Minnesota for a time, and then, of course, most recently in California. And so, every time I'm on campus and I walk past the new stadium, I'm like, wow, that's nice, and way nicer than what we had when I was there.
Oh, yeah. no kidding.
but then really kind of think about, what I've been able to do with what Coach Brown and the other coaches, Shane Beck, taught me, and kind of how I parlay that into, an advocation of being a football official in my community, wherever I've been.
That's really neat. Couple of things come to mind. Yeah, one, the new stadium is amazing. Two, I don't know if you still follow the team. They're doing really well. They're going to be in the, I think it's the MIAC championship. Just beat Carleton the other day, 38-20 or something. So they've had a good season. And then I wonder, have you ever had to throw out parents who are getting unruly or?
Well, It's funny you say that. That's one of the reasons I don't do, I haven't ever done Pop Warner, because okay. those parents are so passionate about what's going on, and it doesn't really matter what's going on. What really is happening on the field, there's how they're perceiving it. And there's no fence between you and them during Pop Warner, where, you know, on Sunday, you know, Friday night under the lights, or Saturday, you know, on the college campus, there's a little bit more structure. And then I only have to deal with angry coaches. They're not really angry. They're just highly passionate. And, everybody wants to talk to the ref, and it makes for a great conversation. And you just say, okay, coach, I understand you're angry. Let's understand we're right, and we're going to go play football now. Okay.
Very good. Yeah. Have you ever had to use your nursing skills on the field while reffing? That's another thing that just occurred to me.
No, luckily not, again, because of the various levels that I was officiating at. They all have their own athletic training staff that can take care of anybody that gets hurt or injured.
Yeah. Okay. So, I find your career path, and it's these twists and turns, really, really interesting. Let's talk a little bit about, that. So what happens after Gustavus? You graduate with a nursing major. Do you go right into hospital work or right into the military?
Well, actually, neither. Kind of like most college students, right when you leave, all the best laid plans just don't end up working out. And so I actually ended up working at Rock Bottom Brewery as a waiter for a while, just because there was a surplus in nurses out there, and that didn't really kind of pan out. I ended up getting a job back at one of the high schools I had attended at Spring Lake Park High School, kind of doing kind of a healthcare internship program with the same program that had gotten me my EMT, the Opportunities in Emergency Healthcare program up at Spring Lake Park High School. So ended up teaching high school for a year. In the nursing market was still rough, so ended up doing some things with a charter airline. Wow. That took me to Los Angeles.
What were you doing for that airline?
Well, it started out just as a great way to fly around as a flight attendant, but then I ended up getting in on the operations side and running all the ground ops for when the airline's aircraft was on the ground at whatever airport we would happen to be at, because it was a charter, we would skip to place to place. So learned a tremendous amount about kind of how the background of the airline industry works. And then finally, after getting into the late 90s, I finally got into my first legitimate nursing job as a neonatal intensive care nurse at LA County Women's and Children's, so County General.
Wow.
The same hospital you'd see the pictures of, you know, for General Hospital, the soap opera.
Right, the soap opera, yeah.
Yeah. It's not the same on the inside as what the soap opera makes it look like, but fantastic experience.
And that must have been amazing. Is that well, first of all, I mentioned before we started recording, my brother lived in Los Angeles for a long time. I mean, that must have been intense, or am I wrong? I mean, what was that experience like?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I think the part, you know, I would have never guessed that I'd be a NICU nurse, but again, it was pretty close to that ER experience with the camaraderie and the teamwork. And then, you know, you're dealing with these micro preemies, you know, that are 480 grams and 26, 27 week gestation. And, you know, it was fascinating. And it's one of those careers that if you, after a few years of doing it, if you don't leave, you will be there forever because it can just grab you and hold on to you. So eventually the draw to the emergency department was too strong, and ended up transferring to getting a job at another hospital in Pasadena and finally getting back to the emergency department.
Now, when you make these, the first one going to neonatal and then the EMT, do you have to do extra training, or is it just sort of you learn on the job? I mean, you have the BA and then thrown into this.
Yeah. So it's a good question because everybody kind of wonders about that. So your basic collegiate, you know, baccalaureate nursing degree just kind of gives you your foundation. And then where you go and where you end up from that is a combination of on the job training versus mentoring or apprenticeships that you do or courses that you go and take. And I think the statistics say that on average, the typical nurse, new grad nurse will spend 18 to 28 months at their first job, and then they'll move around and they'll go somewhere else.
Okay.
And it's not uncommon for folks to start in one position or one department and then kind of move and change as they go through their career.
And of course, so you just reminded me a lot of movement of nurses during COVID, right? I mean, going all over.
Yeah.
Were you involved in that at all in any way? I mean, you were in the military at that point.
So at the time that COVID came out, I was with Providence and I was leading their health innovation technology team. And it's interesting because for a year before COVID hit, we had really been trying to encourage physicians and patients alike to kind of adopt some virtual care modalities, whether it was, you know, online visits or asynchronous visits or, you know, web apps or other things like that. And I would say both on the patient side and the caregiver side, there was kind of a reluctance to change to that. But then COVID completely flipped that whole paradigm on its head. And then my team couldn't keep up with the demand for people wanting what we'd been trying to get them to use before that. I think the stats said in all of 2019, our corner of Providence had done a little over 800 virtual visits. Okay, not terrible, but not anywhere where we wanted to be. And then within 2 months of the onset of COVID, we were averaging 3,600 visits per month.
Oh my God. That's amazing. Jeez. I just listening to you, I can't get over the range of experiences you've had. So how long were you there? And then is it from there that you get into the military?
So I had actually joined the military back in 2008. I had been the manager of the emergency department and short stay unit at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota at the Minneapolis campus. And I had gone to a conference and, you know, like everybody else's Army story, it all starts with, so there I was and I ran into a recruiter. and I was older than your typical recruit. But I had some background and some other things that they were interested in me about. I had looked at joining the military even back when I was at Gustavus, but you know, that was in the down cycle years of the military with the peace dividend and downsizing and size, you know, what we were looking for. And, you know, I wasn't a fit for what they were looking for at the time, but that had all changed in 2008, and then they made me an offer that I couldn't refuse, and I said yes, and I went in as an Army reservist, and have had a multitude of experiences since then. So that's where the Army career started, and then that kind of just ran parallel to my nursing career, whether I was in Minneapolis or California, where I ended up at the time, because I bounced back and forth through my career between Minnesota, California, the East Coast, back to Minnesota, back to California. So it's, again, it goes back to the serendipity.
Yeah.
Not necessarily planned, but an opportunity comes along and then having the courage to say, yes, I'm going to go take advantage of this. And then the mostly goodness that follows from that.
Yeah. This, again, a theme of the podcast and my advising to students, be open to opportunities. It doesn't mean you have to take them, but, you know, if there's something and you know, a little out of your comfort zone, but it seems like it might, you know, lead to, I don't know, broader horizons, interesting experiences, go for it. I'm curious about the military. So when you, it sounds like you met with a recruiter, were you thinking, oh, I can go into the military on the medical side? Was that the idea or just?
Well, so it was a medical recruiter I ran into at a critical care conference in Chicago that I encountered. But, you know, at the time that I encountered him, it wasn't really something I'd been thinking about. I had finished my MBA, kind of like you mentioned in the intro, and I was, you know, full on with the hospital leadership career track. And then this came up and I'm like, well, that would be interesting. And my personality has always been, I crave variety.
Yeah, and I can tell. I can hear you talking about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the Army aspect just seemed to be a good way of, okay, so I have my full-time job and full-time career that I'm doing here. And then on a semi-regular basis, I can slip into this other stream of activities and have something that's completely different. And, you know, then it does for myself, I'm not completely absorbed or taken in on one, and
right,
you can still have that variety that I crave.
Yeah. And then were you within the military, were you doing actually nursing? I mean, were you nursing, or was it all more sort of thinking, organizing, managing?
Yeah. So because of where I was in my career, thankfully the Army didn't put me at the bedside and asked me to take care of some of our soldiers, because, you know, at that point I probably hadn't done direct patient care in 4 or 5 years or more. Okay. So I ended up being a medical planner at, Office of the Command Surgeon, and the Army Medical Department, working on some homeland all hazard response plans and some other things like that. And then I kind of transitioned from that into some more traditional Army mission command type responsibilities before I ended up coming over to what they call civil affairs, which is the department that I, or the branch that I serve in now is as a civil affairs officer.
Right. That's the new command, right? That you just assumed.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll come back to that in a second. But, you know, this, I read a bit and heard you in one podcast, this stint, gig, assignment, whatever word you use, in Poland, is that, or maybe you were based in Germany, but working with Poland, that I found really interesting. I never even thought about that. I mean, how there would be collaboration across allies or countries around, you know, military medical readiness, whatever the correct phrase is. Talk to us a little bit more about that, how you got into that and what that involved.
Yes. Yeah, so with that role, I was a civil affairs officer. And so it came about like right as the onset of COVID. You know, we were living in California, and, the opportunity presented itself for us to go to Europe, and that just seemed like, well, you know, if COVID has to be COVID, you know, and my youngest daughter was doing high school from the kitchen table, and it was like, okay, she can do high school from any kitchen table, and doing it in Europe seems a lot more interesting than just doing it in California. And going to Europe was kind of one of those things that I always kind of had on the desire list for my Army career. So my wife and I agreed that we would go and do it. And I ended up working for within the headquarters for U.S. Army Europe and Africa, the command surgeon's office there. There is a group within it that's called Global Health Engagement. And essentially their mission is to engage with our allies and partners to help develop partner capabilities related to medical and medicine, whether it's institutional medicine, in their military hospitals and clinics, or it's operational field units, combat medics, field hospitals, ambulance companies, air medevac, whether it's rotary wing or fixed wing. So we help build partner capacity. We also try to help work to align those partner capacities so that they work better and are what we call interoperable with U.S. capabilities, meaning that we're able to either work side by side or work within the same geography without getting in each other's way, or even can be able to have exchanges where troops or patients, or we collaborate together, or we put a U.S. healthcare module and attach it to a partner. And then finally is, just to kind of remain partner of choice with our allies and partners. There isn't anything that necessarily keeps an ally or partner to want to continue to work with the U.S. And so we got to put some effort into that and communicate the benefits. And there's certainly some adversarial nations out there that would like to glean away some of our allies and partners. But I think when it comes to, issues and conflicts, I think time and time again, the U.S. has demonstrated that by partnering with and through us and by us working with our allies and partners, we can maintain that rules-based world order that some other nations might be trying to deviate or destroy or diminish, that we all benefit from in the global economy and the safety right. and security that it provides.
Right, right, right. I couldn't agree more. Man, it just sounds, the complexity of that work, at least hearing you talk about it, it must have been amazing. Because it involves... Well, nurses involves doctors, I assume, as well, of course. It involves, I imagine, not only care on or near battlefields, but just sort of ongoing everyday care. Were you just sort of going to one meeting after another with Polish counterparts, or exactly were you doing?
Yeah, so I initially, when I got there, I had a whole portfolio of nations that I was responsible for, whether it was Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Slovenia, Italy, the UK.
Wow.
So there was a multitude and US relationships with each of them are a little bit different. How we interact with each are a little bit different. But as my time progressed there, we had the sunsetting of COVID. Okay, thankfully that made life and travel much easier and work a lot easier. And then we could actually do some more face-to-face engagements. Then we had the withdrawal from Afghanistan and how that involved our various partners and allies. And there were definitely health aspects to that that we had to manage. But, really when we had the Russian, aggression against Ukraine, yes. My world really shrunk down to focusing on Poland. And helping work with Poland as Poland worked with both Ukraine and as we were really the amount of engagements and the amount of other things that we were doing as we build up our U.S. presence there. A significant part of my portfolio was working the concept of support for how we're going to have Poland provide or assist with the medical care for our troops that are stationed within the Polish base, the bases in Poland that we're establishing under the new U.S. Army garrison Poland, and a multitude of everything. So, my conversations went everywhere from the embassy to the Polish Surgeon General to other general officers down into support garrison, support units. My wife would always tell me to go check for my mail every time I went to Poland because it was probably going to be there instead of at home because I was there more often.
That's funny.
But it was a great experience. Fantastic.
Oh, it sounds great. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
In the friendships that I made and the partnerships that we created in that 3 years have just been priceless and I'm so appreciative of them.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of going to ask you about that. What are some of the, you know, memorable moments of this, of the last 3 years, or what is there? I mean, you love variety, so maybe this isn't the question to ask you, but is there some particular moment or particular aspect of that work the last 3 years that really grabs you, that you remember so fondly? Is it just the friendships, or was there something else?
For me, it's all about the people. I mean, and it's the same thing that keeps me in the Army is, you know, the most amazing people that I can encounter seem to be those that have stood up and raised their right hand and said that I'll serve. And whether it's in the British Army or the Polish Army or the Hungarian Army or, you know, wherever else I encounter people, I truly find, you know, reaffirmation and value in those relationships that I'm able to build and forge and then hopefully sustain over time. And that's, it's not a single one of event, but it's the culmination of the people and experience that I've been able to have.
Yeah. That's, I mean, in a way, an extension of Gustavus, right?
in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah. Yeah. What about, so you now with the new command, is that something, I'm sorry, I have no idea how any of this works, but is that something you apply for, or you're just told, okay, you're going to Buckeye, Arizona to be in charge of the Civil Affairs Battalion? How, is that something you sought, or how did it come about?
Yeah, so you kind of get to a point in your career. So I'm a lieutenant colonel now, and yes. And you submit your application to a centralized selection board and say, essentially, tell the Army, I am interested in taking on a battalion command. And then the board looks at all the different applications and you kind of say, hey, these are the units that I would be interested in, or how far I'm willing to travel from home, or something like that. And then the board results come out and the Army selects where you're going to go. And I feel blessed and very lucky that I got one, a Civil Affairs Battalion, I think is fantastic. And I'm super excited about the mission that they have. Two, it's not too far from home. So I just drove here to Phoenix from Southern California for my assumption of command ceremony this past weekend.
Congratulations.
And thanks. And, you know, in three, I think the mission and the exercises and things that the battalion is working towards are very exciting. And the previous commander has done an excellent job of, you know, navigating COVID as best that they could, in keeping the unit cohesion and esprit de corps. I feel very lucky and blessed to be picking up the unit where I am and excited to see where we can go for the next couple of years together.
Well, what is the mission? I mean, what do they do?
So my battalion is what we call geographically assigned to the Indo-PACOM combatant command. So that's a joint command for all of everything from the California coast to the China coast, all the way down to Australia, the Philippines, all of Oceania. And so the civil affairs, we similar to what I was doing under medical security cooperation in Europe, they have a broader building partner capacity, partner relationship, and understanding what we call the civil terrain of where with our partners and allies and where conflict might occur. And so an easy way to think of it is a civil affairs officer is essentially a diplomat for the Army.
Okay.
That can function at any level of government from city, counties, region, province, all the way up to national, depending on what the needs are of the situation.
Wow. Again, congratulations. That sounds pretty, that sounds very impressive.
Oh, it's a very exciting mission.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's great. And when people ask me what we do, I say, hey, we walk around and talk to people and try to reduce friction, and I'll get everybody on the same page and working and collaborating together.
And so this is a step away from the strictly or mostly medical. Am I right about that?
Yeah. So this would be more broad based. We could end up doing medical within the battalion formation. We of course have, you know, combat medics. We have a physician assistant. We have some force health protection folks and things like that. So we could end up doing health type activities. That's always an easy way to break the ice with a partner or ally. Everybody seems receptive to medical engagements.
Eating and medicine is a way to go.
right. Agriculture is another good one that we can engage and partner on. So whether it's safe water or it's, you know, agriculture and markets to economies to ports to airports, it runs the spectrum of where the troops within the battalion could end up engaging with partners and allies.
Okay. So you obviously have an interest in international affairs or relations. I mean, you just were talking about that, really. And when did you earn your MA? Is that recent, or what prompted you to go that route?
Yeah.
That advanced degree.
Well, so I got my MA when I was in Europe. And in part, it came about because as an Army reservist in my civilian career before, I was always so used to having my full-time normal job. And then what I joked was my full-time Army job with part-time pay. and then family and everything else on top of that, that when we got to Europe and I was only doing Army without a civilian component to it, I had some extra time on my hands. And right there within the headquarters at the Education Center, they had some fantastic partnerships with different universities that would offer programs through some type of distance learning channel, whether it was asynchronous or telecast or simulcast or, you know, whichever else. And so I ended up completing my MA in a year through the University of Oklahoma and getting my Master of Arts in International Relations. And it just kind of happened, I guess.
Which is, I mean, perfect for what you're, and that's before the civil affairs posting, obviously, but it relates in all kinds of ways, clearly. That's wonderful. I just love it. I mean, you're just someone who keeps on learning, obviously, which is the whole point of, to me, being alive, you know. That's why I call the podcast Learning for Life. Now, I want to go in a slightly different direction because you've had, you know, you've been in the civilian healthcare sector and the military. Are there, I mean, I don't know, you go, and by the way, are you doing the current position full-time? That sounds like full-time. Or are you still doing civilian positions as well? Or
right?
Shouldn't I ask?
Yeah, no. So now it's kind of back to the full-time Army Reserve job with part-time pay. And okay. So on the civilian side, so that, you know, I can pay the bills and visit Ainsley there at Gustavus and do all those other things that we like to do. Yeah. I'm actually going to be working with University of California, Irvine. They have some significant construction projects, a new hospital, two medical office buildings, a rehab center. And so I'm going to be working with them on all of their health IT, hospital tech, and innovations as they look to build their hospital of the future.
That's amazing.
In Irvine.
I honestly, just listening, I don't know how you do it. That alone sounds like a full-time, you know, I don't know, 12, 15-hour a day job. But what I was going to ask you about is the crossover. I mean, in terms of, I mean, you're in the civilian sector, you're looking, thinking, you know, managing, et cetera. Are there things you think our civilian healthcare system could learn from, should adopt that you've seen in the military sector? I mean, I don't even know how much, you know, crossover there is. Just speaking sometimes as a patient, it seems like our own healthcare system is a mess, but that's another podcast.
Right? Well, I think, you know, I think they both continue to learn from each other. You know, okay. I think civilian healthcare kind of really started to take away what that accountable health organization might look like from, you know, the VA or the military health systems, where
yes.
the clinics are integrated into the hospitals and then vice versa. And now you see the Department of Defense starting to learn from, you know, the Kaiser Permanentes and the Cleveland Clinics and the Mayos of how to manage that network a little bit better. And so with the Defense Health Agency that's now been established by law and is kind of getting fully formed and stood up now, the military health system is going through that, you know, forming, storming, norming procedure, of having even more unified, not just unified within a service, but now unified across the services, so that, you know, we're not replicating a health system for the Army and a health system for the Navy and a health system for the Air Force.
Right.
That, you know, hopefully we can work smarter, stronger, better, which briefs well, but admittedly, you know, especially when we get into, you know, tactical medicine, you know, what the Army needs in a battle is different from what the Navy needs versus how the Air Force functions. And so there's some growing pains that are going to be happening and continue to happen there as those cultures and systems come together and we figure out how do we do things in peacetime versus times of conflict and areas of conflict and, you know, how that builds back into the homeland and the homeland capabilities and things like that.
Right. Yeah, I was thinking, I mean, I'm just thinking about, you know, well, doing some reading, but, you know, what the civilian sector can learn from the military sector, vice versa, around something like, you know, like a COVID, another, I mean, there will be another pandemic at some point. I mean, that's inevitable, but just, the complexity of the military alone, as you just said, it's not like there's one size fits all when it comes to combat needs around medicine. And so, boy, you're in the, if you've given your personality, Jess, you're in the right field, I'd say. Man, it's amazing. So the we wind down here. I wonder, you know, you obviously have positive feelings about Gustavus that came through and comes through in what you've said. But are there times you find yourself really, I mean, consciously thinking, wow, I'm drawing on something I learned back when, you know, in what I'm doing right now?
Yeah, I think, you know, my career and what I've been able to experience and what I've been able to do and to be a part of is, you know, it all started with those roots that go back to, you know, the EMT program in high school and then it carrying through with the nursing program and other experiences I had in college. You know, I even look at, you know, what I learned from Phil Keyboard in, you know, my communication studies when I'm communicating and I'm negotiating with partners and allies to craft an international agreement. And, you know, those rules of rhetoric and all the rest of that kind of stuff. And, you know, even the ability to write.
Oh, I was hoping you would say that.
You know, writing across the curriculum.
Yes.
You know, it wasn't just a tagline. And as torturous as it might have been, especially I'll be the first to admit, I think spell checker was invented for me. you know, it just continued to pay dividends and, you know, it's foundational and then you just don't ever know where it's going to take you or what's going to come up next.
Yeah, that is, boy, you just made my day because I love when someone in a field where, you know, students might think, well, you don't have to do much writing, you know, in commercial real estate or, oh yeah, you do, you know, and in your field, it does matter. So, I was so happy you said that. Thank you. I will be quoting you in my class tomorrow as I hand back, papers. I'm serious. Maybe I'll even make them listen to this part of the podcast at least. So, do you have any, thoughts about, like, I mean, imagine you're advising, a current student about life, careers. I mean, what are Jess's rules for a good, if there are Jess's rules, or good guidelines for, you know, how to make the most out of life and learning? Because you've done that, you continue to do it, obviously.
Yeah, I think it comes down to serendipity, keeping your options open, looking for balance, but always willing to be, you know, willing to take a chance. And the other thing I told some of my soldiers is you need to constantly stay uncomfortable. If you're too comfortable with where you're at and it's too simple, too easy, too routine, it should be a signal to you to say, okay, I need to shake things up a little bit. I need to find something. And it could be a new hobby. It could be a certificate program. It could be a multitude of different things. And maybe it's even just learning, you know, taking some auto classes so that you can fix your own car instead of taking it to the shop. But, you know, continue to learn, continue to grow and develop, and you never know where it's going to take you, or how those skills might be beneficial for you.
Right. And I mean, there's no way you could have imagined as an undergraduate nursing major at Gustavus that you'd be doing what you've done and started.
That the Surgeon General of Poland would be the best friend. And every time I walk into her office, I get a big giant bear hug, regardless how many general officers I'm standing there with. And those are just phenomenal life experiences. And, you know, I'm not done yet, and I'm
far from it.
Who knows where things go from here, but, you know, it's been a fantastic journey to this point.
Well, you're kind of anticipating my last question, and I don't want to put you on the spot. And you're not a spokesman for the military, obviously. We should stipulate that. But do you think you want to, I mean, at this point, it's a plan to, you know, looking ahead 10 years, continue with the military? Or, man, I don't know, you could be an ambassador, for God's sakes, or something. You could be in, seriously. But I mean, do you think beyond, you know, the current command much? Or,
yeah, I mean, again, my Army career has been phenomenal. I've benefited from fantastic mentors and commanders and coworkers that I've been able to serve with and learn from. So I'm absolutely excited for where my career goes. Currently, under current legislative constraints, I have about 10 years before they're going to force me to retire.
To retire, yeah.
Maybe Congress will take a look at that and say that, you know, that's too early and we want to extend that out, which I would appreciate, because of the joy and how much I enjoy my time with the Army and, like I said, the people. And who knows? We'll see what the next position or post is going to be. Right now, you know, I just took command of this unit here, and I'm really focused on what we can do and accomplish together over my planned 2 years of command time, and then we'll see what comes next.
Well, best of luck with the command, and again, congratulations. It's exciting. And I look forward to meeting you in person. I don't think I was there when you were there. You graduated in 96. My wife Kate and I started in 86, but look, maybe we crossed paths. I don't remember, but I, you know, look forward to meeting you certainly when Ainsley graduates this spring, if not before. And I have thoroughly enjoyed this. I just am so impressed. You know, Gustavus alums are, I'm trying not to use the F word here, but, you know, they're just incredible. And you're an example of that. I really mean that. Just the range of experiences and the expertise you've developed and the, you know, the constant learning, and as you've said, being open to change or chance and opportunities, all super important lessons. So thank you so much. I salute you, literally.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to spend some time today with you as well. This has been fantastic.
Great. Yeah. All right. Take good care. And maybe I'll even see you in Phoenix. I'll look up in Phoenix if we get out there to see my sister-in-law and her husband this spring. But thanks again and all the best.
All right. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, ciao.
Learning for Life at Gustavus is supported by the Offices of Marketing and Communication and the Provost. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus itself.